Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, July 22nd, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Mike McKean, sitting in for Amy Simons, and joining me are the Missouri School of Journalism's undergraduate Dean Linda Kraxberger and KOMU-TV's managing editor Jamie Gray. On our agenda this week, Donald Trump makes light of John McCain's time as a Vietnam POW. Many are pointing fingers at the news media for slighting serious Republican presidential candidates in favor of wall-to-wall coverage of the real estate mogul. Those small drones you can buy for a few $100s can make great news-gathering tools. They can also endanger the lives of emergency workers. Just ask the professionals battling California's wildfires. Gawker, the news site that specializes in celebrity scandal, runs a story about a married man trying to hire a male escort, then pulls the piece after widespread condemnation. Two editors who approved the story have resigned in protest. Were journalists too quick to blame sexism for the forced resignation of Reddit CEO Ellen Pao? And what do we make of Harper Lee's new novel, Go Set a Watchman? First on our list, the Donald. Is he a serious presidential contender or a cartoonish distraction promoted all too willingly by news organizations chasing ratings and page views? The latest outrage came this weekend at an Iowa candidate forum put on by a group of Christian conservatives. Trump complained about former nominee and Arizona Senator John McCain, who said Trump was stirring up crazies in the party with his comments about Mexican immigrants being drug dealers and rapists. The forum's moderator, Frank Luntz, interjected, saying McCain was a war hero. Trump disagreed.
He's not a war hero.
He's a war hero.
He's a war hero.
5.5 years.
He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you.
Do you agree with that?
He's a war hero. Because he was captured.
McCain, as you'll recall, was tortured and imprisoned for more than 5 years after his fighter jet was shot down over Hanoi. Several of the other GOP presidential hopefuls and many party leaders lashed out at Trump for trashing McCain. Some called for Trump to drop out. McCain told MSNBC's Mika Brzezinski that he didn't think Trump owed him an apology.
But I think he may owe an apology to the families of those who have sacrificed in conflict and those who have undergone the prison experience in serving their country.
The other Republicans running for president haven't been shy in calling for Trump to apologize or even drop out of the race. Some in the media, including the Wall Street Journal and the Des Moines Register, have done likewise in their editorial pages. Well, let's talk about this a little bit, Linda. I'm wondering if the Trump-McCain story is hurting Trump any more than his comments on Mexican immigrants. I mean, at least one magazine put it this way, Trump is toast, but I'm not quite sure that evidence is bearing that out just yet.
No, I think right now evidence is bearing out that any publicity is good publicity, and Trump is really king of the entertainment soundbite. He's made quite a fortune for himself in entertainment, and I think the real public don't believe that he's going to last the full campaign, but right now he's a big distraction. And unfortunately, I think our even this show kind of plays along with that. We're not talking about the other candidates. We're talking about Trump.
Yeah, and Jamie, we have at least one big conservative media celebrity, Rush Limbaugh, who's out there. He's not a fan of McCain, of course. He's defending Trump, and Trump's doing well in the polls. Last one that came out shows him actually slightly ahead of the other Republican candidates. So it doesn't seem that this coverage is hurting him yet.
No, it doesn't. And when you look at, I think, the charts that have come out showing the coverage of Trump compared to the other candidates, I mean, it's just so vastly more. But it's these sound bites like the one that we just played that is what is driving the news media, particularly in television, to grab onto what he's saying and air it.
Yeah, I wonder if we really could avoid covering the Donald, or is there any other way we could be covering him more responsibly, given the fact that he is making news?
I'm not sure that we can resist the temptation of just playing the sound bites and then having people respond to that, because he is talking about things that touch on real issues. The responsible way to do it is kind of the boring way to cover it, and I'm not sure that the American public would actually pay attention if we covered it more responsibly.
Well, and I think there's a difficulty, too, in the way that we cover campaigns is that we want to give fair time, equal time, to every single candidate. When you have a field that is as wide and as broad as there is in the Republican Party right now, it makes it difficult to do such. And so I think that there are news outlets that are grabbing onto some sort of story angle, and this one happens to be perhaps the juiciest right now.
I thought it was kind of interesting, the Huffington Post, which, you know, mm-hmm. leans left and,
right.
of course,
mm-hmm.
doesn't like Trump anyway, decided, at least for a while, to move their coverage of Trump in protest over to their entertainment section. Well, I mean, that's right. kind of cute, but, you know, there are other people who are saying that we really shouldn't take him lightly, that we ought to try to shine a light on what he actually believes in, or at least says he believes in. So what do you think of the HuffPost and their little...
Sure. I mean, I thought that was interesting when they put it out. I mean, it was certainly a statement that became a news story in itself when Huffington Post decided to do that. Then, of course, Donald Trump responded to that, and it became yet another storyline that was a Donald Trump storyline. And I don't know that it effectively did what they were trying to do in pushing the coverage somewhere else. It just created more coverage.
You know, Linda, Jamie was mentioning a little while ago these charts. There were two political scientists mm-hmm. who wrote a piece in the Washington Post. It's on our links blog. And looks to me like their research is pretty convincing. You see these two charts and they show the amount of coverage of Trump compared to the right. other candidates. And then you see the poll numbers and they pretty much track in line. The more news coverage Trump
right.
gets,
right.
the higher his poll numbers.
Right. Well, and I again, this, you know, the more PR about someone, the more their name is in the news, the more people are looking into them. And for all of the negative publicity that Trump has received, he also speaks to a population in the U.S. who are don't like immigrants, and a population in the U.S. who might think that the U.S. is soft in its foreign policy. And so he is speaking to some real issues, but in a very, you know, out there kind of way, a way that is, I think, is irresponsible.
I also think there might be another issue at play here in that you have so many candidates and some of them have similar beliefs. And so they're splitting votes, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so then when you have someone who's an outlier candidate, outlier in the way of having beliefs that maybe veer much more differently than everyone else's, there's the chance that they are picking up more votes when you have votes in the polls than you have splitting in other areas.
Well, let's dig into that just a little bit, because all of this really matters, of course, because now CNN and Fox, that are going to be carrying the presidential debates leading up to the Iowa caucuses, are using these polls. They're averaging the public opinion polls to decide, because there are 16 candidates right now, who gets on the main stage and who gets kind of on the baby stage. You know, they're going to mm-hmm. do a primetime debate with 10 candidates and then six others who get less exposure. So this does matter to those candidates.
It does. And I think that is particularly unfortunate. Regardless of whether or not Trump had said anything at all, his name recognition compared with other candidates, I think, is so great that he would have done well in that particular arena, no matter what. That was inevitable.
But I mean, Jamie, somebody has to set some kind of rules or parameters right. for these debates. I just wonder, though, if news organizations should be using public opinion polls to decide who gets on the stage and who doesn't.
I think that's a tricky thing. And I've dealt with this at local news stations where I've worked, when we'll do a gubernatorial debate. Who are we going to have when you have so many candidates that perhaps have filed to run? Where I've worked in the past, it's been how much campaign funding have candidates raised so far, and putting those type of criteria. But we didn't have access to the type of public opinion polls that the national news media does. That being said, is there a better way to measure? I don't know. No matter what you do, you somehow have to quantitatively make that decision. You can't have a 16 candidate debate. It just won't work.
So meanwhile, you have some of the candidates with lower numbers thinking the only way I'm going to get any coverage is to talk about Donald Trump. So we just feed the fire. That's the way they're trying to get attention. Mm-hmm. Well, we all know by now about the terrible drought in California, and you may have seen video of the latest wildfires, including one over the weekend that jumped a freeway north of Los Angeles and destroyed a bunch of cars there. Well, what you may not know is that amateur videographers have been sending up drones to capture some of those images. And some of those drone pilots are trying to sell their video to TV stations. firefighters don't really like that. So what you're seeing now, if you're watching our show online or on air, is a couple of examples. Here's a bit of video of drones flying over a ridgeline, and you can see some very dramatic pictures of smoke coming up from a big forest fire. You're also going to see some pictures here in just a second of a plane that's flying over and dropping some chemical fire retardant on the flames there. Well, those were all shot by the same drone pilot, and they're very dramatic shots, of course. The only problem is that those drones are endangering firefighters, or at least that's the claim. They could crash into a plane. They could get sucked into the engine of a plane. Back on July 12th, firefighters actually grounded their tankers over a fire in San Bernardino County for about 10 minutes until the drones got out of the way. Officials have even taken to running public service announcements on TV in California, trying to warn viewers about the safety hazard. So let's talk about that. I mean, clearly the fires are newsworthy, Jamie. The public wants to see video. We would normally in the olden days and still send up news helicopters to get this kind of footage. So how's that different from these folks taking their drones up in the air to capture it?
Well, generally speaking, when you have these news helicopters going up in situations like this, a lot of times you're coordinated with the command staff over a fire. In this case, this was not a coordinated effort. And I do worry how this may impact journalists, because on this very program, I've talked about how valuable it would be in wildfire coverage to be able to use drones, but more from the perspective of going in after and checking to see how many structures had burned and those types of things. So now I worry that these amateur drone pilots are going to be damaging to those of us who want to coordinate and fly drones safely to get an idea of what's going on.
Well, and in fact, Linda, we're in a very sensitive time right now for the media, because the FAA regulates these drones and has said you can't fly them. They've granted a few exemptions to some large news organizations to do some experiments before they come up with some new rules. And this certainly doesn't help the cause.
No, it doesn't help the cause. And the other problem with this is it presents an ethical dilemma for journalists and journalism organizations. Much like when paparazzi surround celebrities, we have a problem. When we have amateurs flying drones, then a news organization has to make a determination. Are we going to purchase that video? Are we going to, if we didn't shoot it ourselves, are we still culpable for any activity that might occur or any problems that occur because that video has been shot? And I think, you know, some journalism organizations need to draw some hard lines about when and what kind of video they will accept and won't accept, and under what conditions.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, in this case, the firefighters, in some of the sound bites that were played from the firefighters after this, they talked about having to dump retardant not on the fire because they needed to land. So they had to get rid of fuel and fire retardant. And then the safety aspects that you mentioned, it became its own story in the news media. And it doesn't look good for those of us that want to be able to use drones to have a new way to gather news.
I will add, though, in all of this, it's unfair for news organizations who are attempting to use drones responsibly. It's unfair for us to have one set of rules and then have a very different set of rules for hobbyists, for people who aren't held accountable for their actions.
Well, undoubtedly, we're going to be coming back to this story. And unfortunately, because of the drought situation in California, it wouldn't be surprising if this particular aspect of the story comes up again. Well, Gawker Media, as some folks know, is best known for its salacious coverage of the private lives of celebrities. Last Thursday night, Gawker ran a story about a New York magazine executive married with three kids who allegedly solicited sex from a male prostitute. It so happens that that executive is also related to a former member of President Obama's cabinet. Apparently, the sex worker took the story to Gawker himself when the executive refused to help him with an unrelated business dispute. Well, the reaction has been immediate and almost entirely negative. Nick Denton, who is the CEO and founder of Gawker, decided to pull down the story after consulting some of his board members. The two top editors who approved publication of the piece resigned in protest. Linda, was there any redeeming value at all in this story?
I was just thinking about people doing the right thing, but for the wrong reasons. And I think it's kind of ironic that somebody finally decides to get some moral backbone when their whole company is built around a model of purveying gossip, basically. I mean, there's some good journalism that goes on Gawker, but there's also a lot of trash that goes on that site. And to suddenly get a conscience and then decide as CEO that I'm going to take over the editorial independence of my quote unquote newsroom, I think is a little ugly.
You kind of want to feel sorry for Nick Denton when he says something in a meeting like, this is not the company I built, oh boo-hoo, but it kind of is the company he built.
Well, and he knew about the story before it was published that night. He could have asked more questions when he found out about, he hadn't read the full story, but he also, from what I've read, didn't ask to read it until it was already published. And then once it got pulled down, if you go to the article where it says Gawker has pulled down this article, it has a link to its old article via the Wayback Machine of the internet, because nothing ever really disappears on the internet. So I thought that was, you're pulling it down,
right?
But you're still referencing back to the copy. So
the damage is done.
They didn't even pull it down because they linked to the old story.
Okay, so but the two editors who quit, I mean, basically their arguments were, we have a tradition of transparency here at the Gawker, and you know, as long as it's true, it's okay to publish.
Radical transparency, right. Not just transparency, radical transparency.
But if it's true, then it's okay to publish.
Right. Well, that's not journalistic. If you really wanted to be a journalism organization, in addition to being independent, you would also tell the truth and you would do no harm. And how can they do stories that harm people's reputations and really think of themselves as ethical journalists? I think it's a little interesting that the editors are, you know, standing for this big J journalism here, when in fact they've been doing some things that are kind of harmful all along.
Well, and in that vote that they took that was, I guess, 4-2 to remove the article, the people that voted to take it down were people like the president of advertising and partnerships. And we're talking about crossing that editorial line. The people who voted to keep it were the general counsel and can't think of the other person, but the people who were voting to pull it down were people that generally would not be and should not be involved in making news judgment decisions. Again, Gawker, and looking at it from a traditional news organization standpoint, I don't know that you can quite do that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. The editors, they might have some sympathy among journalists saying, oh, we got to have this firewall between sales and the business side, except for the kind of story it was.
Exactly.
And the damage that, you know, they've done to a private citizen, really. Well, anyway, we talked about that story. Now, there's another controversy that's come up in the past couple of weeks since we've been off the air. And that story involves another big name in digital media, Reddit, or the so-called front page of the internet, as they like to call themselves. The company fired Victoria Taylor. She was a well-respected executive, and she was responsible for working with Reddit's large number of volunteer editors. Well, those editors temporarily shut down many of the subreddits, or the topic areas on the site, in protest. They also started a petition calling on Reddit CEO Ellen Pao to resign. More than 200,000 people signed that petition, and many people on Reddit and elsewhere personally attacked Pao, some with some really sexist and even misogynistic language. Well, a week ago Friday, Pao quit, and you may recall she's been in the news before. She's the same tech executive who recently lost a big sex discrimination lawsuit that she'd filed against the venture capital firm Kleiner Perkins out in Silicon Valley. Some of the news media have played up that sexism angle over everything else in the Reddit controversy. The New York Times headline reads, "It's Silicon Valley 2, Ellen Pao 0, fighter of sexism is out at Reddit." And our friends at Gawker put it this way, "Misogynistic tantrum officially drives Ellen Pao from Reddit." Well, you know, obviously there is a gender problem in American technology firms, but the Reddit story seems to me, at least, Linda, to be a bit more complicated than that.
Well, I think it is complicated on a number of different levels. First of all, the person that she fired that caused this firestorm is a woman. So there is, gender on gender difficulties there. I think any person who has been high enough up in a business to understand human resources and personnel knows that there is always much more to the story that cannot be told. And just because the facts point to this thing, misogynistic comments are made against Ellen Pao on Reddit boards and on the internet. Yes, misogynistic comments are made about lots of women and lots of men on the internet. So that in and of itself isn't the indicator here. And I think just because something is true doesn't, certain facts suggest this, but that doesn't equal cause.
I also think you have to take into consideration the culture of Reddit, if you will. I'm a Redditor, if you will. I'm on there looking at different subreddits, and some of mine got shut down during all of this. But I think that if you are a frequent user of Reddit, you know that there can be an internet mob mentality of people who are on Reddit, so-called Redditors. And they can get pretty vicious, and often that spins off and determines some of the news cycle that comes out. A lot of news organizations, in fact, will find stories through Reddit and then use those. So I think Reddit's a little bit of a different beast in itself.
Yeah, and I mean, we don't want to belittle the problem, because we've talked about on this show before just how bad gender culture there is in Silicon Valley, and frankly, among some of the media that cover technology.
Correct. I don't know what to say. You know, I always hate when we leap to a conclusion. And I think in this case, there might be people who regularly cover the internet and internet issues. And they might say, yes, again, this is once again discrimination. But I think there might be more to this story. And it might have to do with how Ellen Pao is as a CEO.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting because several times readers on the New York Times site made some comments about how they thought the original story that the Times ran, which was more neutral, it was a breaking news piece, was, you know, a fairly standard kind of fair coverage of the piece. But then later they rewrote it and focused largely on the sexism angle with that headline I talked about. So to the Times' credit, they have a public editor, Margaret Sullivan. Mm-hmm. And she wrote about it, and she, I thought, interestingly, found herself kind of straddling the fence on this.
Absolutely. And it's the whole interesting thing when you deal with the internet, and anytime you make an addition to a story that's already been posted, what do you do with that? Do you start an entirely new post, or do you add to it and put an editor's note? For example, at KOMU, we have a very hardline policy on this. Anytime anything gets changed, we put an editor's note at the bottom and explain what was changed, put an updated tag on it, and try and really tell you exactly what we've changed about a story. But not every news organization has that hard of a policy. And then there's the whole issue of trying to look at, well, if readers are trying to keep up with this story, are they going to go back to the original story to try and keep up with it? Or are they going to go through and try and find that second post? And it's all this kind of new wave of media and trying to figure out how can we update stories and be responsible and transparent about it.
I think it's also interesting that we're having this debate now about the difference between the word analysis and the word opinion.
Right.
Because it's, you know, the Times editors in their defense were saying people come to our paper instead of the commoditized news sources they could go to because they want our perspective. They want our journalist take. But it can very easily veer into opinion.
Well, and I also think the New York Times, in this instance, they are stuck a little bit between a rock and a hard place. They're saying that the bare bones of the story, people can get that anywhere. They don't need to come to the New York Times to get the bare bones of the story. So we're going to give you more analysis, or that they call it the second day coverage. I also think, though, some of that second day coverage, some of that analysis is the very criticism of the New York Times that has many people turning to different kinds of media. I think that was the inception of Fox News, was because people felt that the New York Times was putting too much of its opinion, too much analysis. And so there is a belief that the liberal bias of the New York Times gets in the way of it reporting factually on some stories.
Well, whatever the bias is, don't you think that a lot of reporters now actually, because they're writing online and they're being talking about audience engagement and all these things and differentiating their product, that they feel kind of liberated to inject their own personal perspective into those stories?
I just think that there's a difference. I mean, in some ways you have to, as a journalist, you can't just string together facts and that be your story. You have to understand the context under which things are happening. You have to provide that context, and that shouldn't be your personal opinion, but you do have to offer a little bit of context, and sometimes that can start to feel like opinion because of the way that you're framing a story. And I think that's the biggest challenge of being a professional journalist now.
Well, speaking of commenting, we'd like to take a few moments here at the end of the show to comment on Harper Lee's new novel, Go Set a Watchman. It's described as the sequel to her epic work To Kill a Mockingbird, one of the most influential and best-loved works of the last century. But you know, Lee actually appears to have written Watchmen first, mm-hmm. from what we can gather. It occurs many years later when Scout was now living in New York. She comes back to Alabama, to her hometown, to visit her father. Atticus Finch, who we all know as the hero of To Kill a Mockingbird, he tried to free a black man falsely accused of raping a white woman. Well, now, in the new book, he's a Klan-sympathizing apologist for the Jim Crow South, and it's left a lot of people, readers, critics, social commentators, wondering, what do we make of this book? So I'm curious, and I haven't read it. I don't know if either of you have had a chance to read it yet. It's just been out, but what's your take on what we've read about the book so far?
Well, my take is I'm not surprised that this is selling and selling and selling. It has been a staple of high school English classes for decades. I think Harper Lee's writing, or how much of this she wrote as a prequel before she wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, is evidence of the world that she lived in at the time. And I think they'll probably go together in history as a as an important pair of works. I think people's outrage has to do with the belovedness, if you will, of Atticus Finch as a noble character. And now people are having to rethink, well, was Atticus a noble mm-hmm. character? And I think it provokes really good conversation in our society today.
I also think that one of the issues is, did Harper Lee intend for this to be released? And
ever?
For me, I wondered, from a moral standpoint, do I want to read something? Is it akin to reading someone's diary that they had put away? And did she really want this book to be released? And so from that standpoint, I thought, do I want to read something if it wasn't intended to be released? Of course, there's a lot of controversy with that, with her attorney speaking, and I don't know. And I don't know that we will ever know, did she intend for it? I actually do plan to read it, but I want to reread To Kill a Mockingbird first. So if the Columbia Public Library could scoop me up on that.
I also think that there is a sort of a flip side to that question about what she intended, because whatever she intended, it's clear that she wrote at least parts of Watchmen before To Kill a Mockingbird came out, and her editors basically convinced her to take an entirely different direction. Mm-hmm. And it makes you wonder to what extent the editors, as opposed to the author, were responsible for the sanitized or heroic or whatever version you want to say of the book.
One thing I would just make a plug for Vox Media. This is an organization that I know has been talked about on this program before, but if you don't have time to read every single review and article of it, Vox Media is a great resource to go to when you want to get the Reader's Digest condensed version of each point and why this part is particularly contentious or this part. It's a great summary of all of the issues involved in this particular Harper Lee battle.
And it's kind of hard to see a hero disrobe, but in some ways, you know, Atticus Finch is probably a more realistic portrayal of the struggles over race in the United States than this sort of mythologized version we get from the book.
Sure. And I think, you know, a lot of it is when you read a book, you envision a character a certain way. It's the same thing when you go and see a movie and the character was totally different than you thought that they might be or something like that. And so I think that if you want to read it and see Atticus as two different people and these as two separate works, I think that's fine. But I do think it is interesting that it's coming out now and that, you know, with all of the questions surrounding it. But I think it will be interesting. I'm looking forward to reading it.
I think there's going to be a big discussion because it's already sold more than a million copies, mm-hmm. despite what critics may say about it. Well, that's all our time for this week. Thanks for listening and watching. You can find links to our stories on KBIA.org. You just click on Views of the News under the Programs menu. You can also follow us on Twitter at Views on KBIA, and on Facebook at Views of the News. You can also download our weekly podcast on iTunes if you'd like to listen to it that way. Thanks to Linda and Jamie for sitting in this week, and thanks to our director, RJI's Travis McMillan, and our audio engineer, KBIA's Pat Akers. I'm Mike McKean. Please join us again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.